Hanito, and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki.
Y'all, I have to show you my new favorite soap from Baker's Bar Soapery. Check out this Yunish, which means buffalo in Choctaw. It's scented with leather fragrance, so I bought one for my husband and one for me too, of course, and it smells so good. This soap is a tribute to the Choctaw and the resilience of the buffalo. Luxury soaps, lotions, and lip balms from Baker's Bar Soapery are 100% Choctaw crafted. And yes, these are made with goat's milk, so they leave your skin feeling soft and supple. So load up on these Choctaw soaps made by Tiffany at Baker's Bar Soapery at thebbsoapery.com. But be sure to get 20% off when you use the code NATIVECHOCKTALK, that's all caps, when you spend $25 or more. Treat yourself to the luxury your skin deserves with Baker's Bar Soapery.
Hold on to your hats, y'all, because today's guest is going to share amazing stories and history that will have you both inspired and on the edge of your seat. I am very much honored to present to you Solomon Little Owl of the Crow Nation. Solomon proudly served our country as a Marine and graduated from University of Northern Colorado with a bachelor's degree in social science. He later worked for 12 years as the Director of Native American Student Services at UNC. What some tribes label a chief, the Crow Nation's leader is a chairman, which serves as CEO of the tribe. Solomon was a political appointee sworn in by the chief judge as CEO of the Crow tribe in Montana for 2.5 years, which was the first time in Crow history that a leader was appointed to CEO. He was later appointed by Governor Jared Polis and served as a direct commissioner for the 19th Judicial District in Weld County. In addition, Solomon worked as executive director of Crow Tribal Veterans Affairs, where he advocated for and facilitated grants to improve the lives of Crow veterans. In January of 2023, University of Colorado's Alumni Association awarded Solomon the Honored Alumni Award for providing opportunities to engage in and improve various communities. There are a few reasons Solomon Little Owl received this Alumni Award, but we'll get into that in just a moment. Solomon, welcome to Native Chalk Talk.
Thank you for having me, Rachel.
Absolutely. So you're on the road today. You mentioned to me, hey, I just got to run over to Montana for a minute. So thank you for taking time to visit with us. I really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you.
So listeners, you're going to hear fascinating stories of Solomon's ancestors as well as about the Crow tribe itself. And you'll also learn some, let's just say, intriguing ideas Solomon brought to the table that turned into dollars for scholarships and changes in legislation. But let's start at the beginning. Solomon, how many siblings did you grow up with?
I have two brothers and two sisters. My sisters are school teachers on the reservation, and they teach kind of an immersion program for young Crow kids right now. And then my brothers are both ranchers and farmers and helping my mother with her business on a reservation. And I'm the only one that's living off the reservation.
Well, you really had to go out there and do some things that we're going to talk about in a minute that really blew my socks off. So, and where did y'all grow up?
I grew up in Crow Agency Montana, which is our agency for the tribe. And so I grew up there, was born there, grew up. And then after high school, I joined the United States Marines in 1991.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Why don't you share more about the reservation, if you will?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Like I said, I grew up there. I grew up hunting, fishing, everything we did when it came to hunting and gathering Wild Fruits was all family based. And everybody's all ready to go berry picking right now. They're all waiting for the certain spots. So is my
son. So this
son,
is the season?
Yeah, this is the season. And looks like there's going to be a lot of choke cherries, a lot of June berries, a lot of raspberries, gooseberries. Nice. I know there was a lot of wild carrots and wild turnips this year. So, like I said, that's still kind of more of our tradition to go and gather. So yeah, growing up, I believe we're the only tribe in America that has a hunting subsistence in the lower 48. And so we use our hunting and fishing year round, and we don't have to buy any permits or anything like that. We're kind of like self-regulated as a tribe. But now we've been wanting, I know some people have been wanting to regulate, because there's a lot of, I would say, this new generation of hunters, they just go out and start to kill everything they see. But like I said, it's but like older folks like me, you know, we maybe some kids, I mean, some people over 50 now, we just kind of enjoy watching them, the wildlife, kind of preserve right. them, you know. So like I said, I still hunt and I still fish, but not as much as I used to growing up. Like I said, if I could, I would have been hunting 24/7.
I bet.
All into high school.
What was your favorite thing to hunt?
Pretty much everything that I can eat. mostly, I mean, like I said, we just pretty much hunt elk, deer, and buffalo and moose.
Wow. And so,
like I said, that's not of a, that's kind, not kind of a preferred animal for some
reason.
The
meat's kind of strange though, isn't it? I mean, from what I've heard, the antelope meat.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I said, sometimes, man, they're delicious. They're better than prime rib. But it's always hard to find that time, the best time to kill an ant or a pronghorn. So, but any, like the deer or anything else, they're always good no matter what season they are in.
True, true. Yeah. Well, and speaking of buffalo, we're going to talk about that as well. I have so many questions for you. But ranching runs through your veins as well, right? Tell us about that.
Yeah, correct. My mother is a second generation rancher and farmer, and my dad was as well through some of the Indian programs. I would say right after self-determination started, there was a lot of things that started to happen on a reservation, and there's a lot more opportunities to become a rancher and farmer. And that's where my grandparents on both sides, they both had probably around 200 head of cattle.
Wow.
And that's where my mom and dad came about. But unfortunately, there's another pandemic besides COVID right now, and that was tuberculosis. That tuberculosis really destroyed my dad's side of the family as well as my mom.
Hmm.
So, but my dad's family took more of an impact. And so my grandpa or my dad's family pretty much lost everything because of the tuberculosis. And my mom's side, she, like I said, they had quite a few lands and stuff, but now it's all kind of trickled down. But all the, like, what they established, they lost. And so growing up, my mom and dad decided to become ranchers and farmers again. And so now we just benefited from their hard work. So now it's our turn to try to help them out, make sure that they get the help they need. When it comes to leasing, when it comes to everything else possible, from ranching to making hay, you know, we try to help out as much as possible. And that's where my brothers come in. They were helping my dad a lot. And then in 2000, my dad passed away from COVID, and he passed on everything to my mother. And so we'll see what happens here. And like I said, my mom's doing good. She's excited for this year's harvest, this year's sales as well with her calves. And there's a lot more lands that are coming up for lease for grazing and farming. So we'll see what happens. And that's why I went up to Montana, was to turn in everything that was on the list for us to bid as pros. So we'll see what happens.
Wow. I mean, it's, you just kind of described what I think about Montana, the ranching and the farming and all of that stuff.
A lot of people don't know this, but Yellowstone was kind of based on a Crow reservation. If you see in the first couple of scenes, where what's his name's son drives to a small community, that's actually where my office was right at that old casino.
No way. So,
unfortunately I wasn't in the show, you know. I could have made some money, but you know, that time is coming up soon. But anyway, Yellowstone is actually based on a Crow reservation, and Mr. Sheridan, the writer, I don't know, he loves the Crow culture or something, because a lot of that, what was that, The Bones of Crow or something like that, a movie he just he wrote a movie and he named it after Crow. So Crow, or anyway, so it's just like I said, Mr. Sheridan has a thing for Crow culture. So I was happy about it.
Did you guys also raise buffalo out there?
No, your family? No, actually, that was one of the things we talked about a couple of years ago, and that buffalo meat prices were almost about 3 times as much higher than the cattle right now. So we were very interested in taking that route, but then buffaloes are really hard to manage, and our facilities wasn't even ready. I mean, we have a hard time just with cattle.
Right.
Plus we're right in the middle of some of the big ranchers and non-Crow ranchers and farmers on a reservation. And we have multimillionaires to the north of us, multimillionaires to the south and to the west and to the east. And so, for us, we wanted to make our cattle different. So we started raising, my dad and my mom started raising Red Angus. So we're only the probably one or two people on a reservation that raises Red Angus that are Crow. And then the others are more, the Crows usually raise a lot of Black Angus.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to ask what type of beef it is. So that's the good stuff.
Yeah, they're all good. Like I said, it's kind of hard though. You know, when you raise something and you send it off to the market, it's kind of hard to eat a steak sometimes, or eat a hamburger, and you're like, oh man. Especially, you know, when you raise a calf from birth, being left out in the cold or being abandoned. So it's kind of tough sometimes, but we get through it.
You know, my family, we also have cattle. We have a ranch in Oklahoma, and same thing, where these are the friendliest cows I've ever met. I mean, they're so babied, and they purposely are spread out a little more. So they are definitely like grass fed, treated really well. My uncle named some of them. And same thing when we were growing up, there used to be these baby calves that we would have to feed because their moms abandoned them or whatever the case was. And you'd get attached to them. It's really sad.
What I used to do is for about 18 years, we would raise money and go to the reservation and harvest a couple buffaloes. And a lot of the students that were non-Crow, white, Asian, Black, other tribes, they would come and get a chance to visit the reservation and see some of the old war sites. Battle of the Little Bighorn is actually on my reservation, and so
we go and
visit there. But a lot of kids don't like that museum or that that national park, because I don't know for what reason, but a lot of the students want to hear that Crow history part of, you know, who we fought and, you know, and some of the stories behind it and some of the things why we're there on a reservation. You know, kids love that. You know, then when we stop at different sites, take, for example, when there's a lot of wild plums, we go and stop at plum sites, and kids get a chance to eat wild plums and certain things. And then Like I said, it's we always have fun, you know. Campfire stories bring out the best in people, and
Right.
there's, you know, there's always a better, yeah, there's always a better understanding of human nature when there's a campfire. So I'm like I said, I'm a strong believer of campfires.
Love it. Same.
18 buffalo hunts, all of them except one time were successful. And like I said, we use the buffalo meat to give to Native American students and some of the other
That's
students
awesome.
Who are kind of low on food when it comes to college. You know, a lot of college students don't eat, so
yeah,
we try to help them make that difference.
So last time you and I were talking, there was some kind of story about a man doing some poaching in Wyoming. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes.
It was United States versus Herrera,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Calvin Herrera Jr. Like I said, we were in our first treaty in the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. Our reservation was somewhere around between 32 to 35 million acres. And so we always felt that we needed to get back to our old boundaries in some way or another. So, and we always, I mean, it seems like there's always more elk in Wyoming, you know, and that comes with the phrases, the other side of the pasture is greener. for some reason. Some of the hunters have been, you know, the younger hunters have been trying to, hunt bigger game or trophy hunt. And so they got really tempted and they saw a bull elk on the other side of the reservation, southern part of the reservation, which is in Wyoming. And they shot and killed it and they got caught. And that court case, just recently ruled by the Supreme Court in favor of Calvin Herrera Jr. that the Supreme Court recognizes the old boundaries of the Crow Reservation, which also includes Wyoming and a little bit parts of North Dakota, I believe, and maybe half of Montana. So it's a lot of land.
Wow. I mean, we're talking, it's like 3 million acres or something, right?
Oh, no. I mean, we're talking about almost 30,000 or 30 million acres.
Whoa,
of the
30
old boundaries
million.
Of the Crow tribe. Yeah. And that, the Supreme Court recognizes the hunting and fishing of the Crow tribe, which is just an astounding amount of happiness. I mean, for me.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
But at the time, you know, thinking ahead of some of the things that have always occurred, where you always think as a native person, you think you're going to get a step ahead of the other group.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always other people who are trying to get you to step back even five more steps because they don't want you to get ahead. And so my thought at the time when I was the CEO, I go, we need to have a commission because either the ruling is going to be positive or negative. If we win, we want to make sure that we write our own regulations because as a nation, we have that right to do that.
Right.
Or if we lost, you know, we had to take a step back and how do we, how do we look at hunting and fishing rights as more of a right than not just recreation? Like a lot of the people out here, I mean, it's more recreation than actually hunting.
Hmm.
And I mean, a lot of people don't really, you know, hunt. Yeah. I mean, that's why there's hunting seasons. For us, you know, it's hunting to subsistence living is all year round, and that's what we're used to.
Exactly.
So to me that Calvin Herrera case, you know, made the our treaty stronger, and I'm hoping that this is trickle down, or trickle up, I would say, instead of trickle down, trickle up to affects more of those hunting rights and fishing rights of all the tribes who have old boundaries, and they need to look at those treaties again and somehow take advantage of that. Like I said, it's a blessing for my tribe to, I would say not reclaim, but to be like reinstated as these territories as our old hunting in fishing rights territory. So I'm very happy for that.
Super exciting. Congratulations to the Crow Tribe. And again, that's the Supreme Court ruling, Fort Laramie Treaty, I believe is what it was called, with millions of acres of hunting land in United States versus Herrera, if anyone is wanting to look into that more. Very exciting. And like you said, hopefully that it'll trickle up to other tribes as well. You grew up on the reservation, obviously. And then 2 weeks after graduation, you joined the Marines, as you mentioned earlier. So tell us about how you got interested in and decided to join the Marines.
Like my grandpa, he was, man, he grew up in a rough time in the early 1900s, but because of our family tree, we were also, my great-great-grandpa, who was a chief, his name was Bell Rock, and that's my family lineage. And if you look at Bell Rock, he was the brother-in-law of a lot of maybe two or three chiefs, I believe, but his brother-in-law was Chief Penicoop, who was our last traditional tribal chief. And but he you know, he was the mentor of Chief Penicoop's as well. So I mean, the family lineage, man. We're talking about maybe 20 families now, in on the reservation. They're still there, and so my grandpa always talked about the crazy dogs in Crow. They're called Bishkawalaka, but we know them as crazy dogs, and these are the bravest and the smartest and I would say the craziest, to try to do anything to help save and protect the tribe, both, you know, the women, the children, the elders. And the thing that was missing was the education piece. And I think that's where I knew I could be that part of a warrior in modern day. And also Chief Penicoops, one of his favorite quotes, or one of his famous quotes, was, "With education, you are white man's equal. Without education, you are his victim." And so, to me, I kind of combined both of those thoughts of being a Marine and being educated. And so as a young person, probably in sixth grade, those were some of my goals and dreams, was to be a Marine and to get educated and, you know, help my tribe. So I was kind of, like I said, I would say imprinted when I was a little boy.
I love that. So after the Marines, was that when you decided to go to UNC?
Yeah, no, actually, I went to school in Great Falls with a Veterans Upward Bound program, and they were trying to get veterans into the healthcare field. So in Montana, and this was in Montana, and so we started off with, like, I think about 50 veterans, Native veterans from all over the seven reservations and some of the bigger cities like Billings, Great Falls, Helena, Bozeman, some of those cities had a lot of Native populations as well. So we started out with 50, and then at the end of the first semester, there was maybe 15 of us left. And then at the end of the semester, all of us was, and we're all gone. You know, that that transition was pretty hard.
Yeah.
And for me, I had no kids or no wife or, I mean, no dependents. But majority, I would say, out of 50, about 45 had dependents. And so going to school and try to make ends meet for rent, man, it was really tough on them. And I felt bad for them, because we're all like, yes, the end is going to be, you know, successful. You're going to make money, you're going to come out of poverty and everything. But the starting part was so rough that those other students couldn't handle it or couldn't take it anymore. So it was like I said, learning experience for me.
Right. Wow, that's kind of a sad story that we do hear quite often, those challenges that some of our people go to school and it's just, it's a lot. And like you said, especially when you have kids, there's that dropout rate, understandable.
Yeah. I met my wife there.
Oh, you did?
My girlfriend at the time. Yeah, we met in college. And so she transferred to Greeley, UNC, to be a special ed teacher. And I followed her. So this past June, we've been married 26 years with two kids.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. And she's also an alumni of Colorado State University and alumni of UNC. And so I followed her down to Greeley, started school in 97, and then graduated in December of 2000. Yeah, so right after work, I got hired on by UNC.
Right, and you did some really cool things there. First off, I want to hear all about the buffalo hunts. Tell us from how you got started with that idea and how it all evolved and all that.
Well, about the first month on campus, I got invited to the Native American Student Service Center. And I had a chance to meet natives from all over Colorado. And there's probably about 10 of us in the student body. And they were the director at the time was wanting to have a powwow. And, you know, he wanted to do guest speakers. And that's kind of what a lot of universities do. It's kind of the same line. And so, and one of the students goes, you know, let's have an authentic buffalo hunt. And so, he said, let's have an authentic Native American event that nobody else does it.
Right.
And everybody was just kind of looking around like
what is that?
So I said, well, I still hunt, you know. I go, let me ask for a buffalo from my tribe and, you know, let's go harvest it. And everybody said, yeah. So a couple of days later, we got a buffalo, and that was our first hunt, and that was in 1997. And unfortunately, we made it to the mound. I mean, we got up to the mound, and what was waiting for us was 2 feet of snow.
Oh, boy.
And so, yeah, because we had a big old snowstorm, and we never did get a chance to see the buffalo.
Oh, boy.
Man. People enjoyed themselves, man. You know, they were just blown away by how beautiful the reservation was and the mounds and everything. And and then we're like, well, you know, let's plan for next year. But the tribe was also very supportive too. You know, you know, they made sure, you know, they were there to help us during the snowstorm and to pull out some of the trucks. I mean, like I said, we're 2 feet of snow and there's no roads. The only road there is there's a dirt road, and we're probably an elevation of about 10,000, 500 or so. And it was, you know, pretty high.
Right.
As we're driving through the snow, it was also windy. So, and like a truck might be in front of you for like 10 feet by the time you get to that truck's tracks, it's covered with snow.
You
really, really have to be careful. And then and was a learning process for me, because like I said, I was a student and I wasn't the one in charge of taking care of the kids. I was more in charge of getting the buffalo. And that following year, I became the leader of everything. So yeah, I had to really watch out for who we took. We made sure students wrote waivers, making sure that we, you know, they understand the weather, how cold it is. We need to know their health, you know, their extreme health. Maybe it's from diabetic to, I don't know, just something, maybe seizures. I don't know. So I had to really, really, really be careful of to make sure all the students were protected. And
yeah,
and that was the same year. That was the same year where we had, I believe, 16 Eastern Europe students that came with us, and they're all international students.
These students weren't all Native American then. So
no,
you had
no,
kind
no.
of a hodgepodge
yeah.
of, okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah. And that was, yeah, that was the most European students we ever took. I mean, they were a blast. They're like, wow, this is crazy. You know, buffalo.
It's the coolest thing we've ever done. I would say the same thing. I've never been on a buffalo hunt. I've been around buffalo many times, but I've never been on a hunt. So did people know how to shoot already, or did you have to teach them ahead of time?
No. So we had a designated shooter. And so,
oh, okay. So they just went
so
along with y'all.
Yeah. Yeah. And
okay,
so
gotcha.
They had a chance, you know, they had a chance to watch us skin and take out the insides and kind of show them what we usually use for, you know, for weapons and for tools to cook and all these other things. And so we showed the kids, the ones that participated firsthand and what to expect, you know. And that was kind of a survival skill for them, because, you know, we showed them how to do it, and they were like, wow, this is crazy. And some of them were like, this is what cows look like, you know, because a lot of kids didn't know where, you know, they knew how to, you know, all they know is hamburger, but they really don't realize that there's a process.
Right. It actually comes from an animal.
So yeah, it was good for them. And but like I said, campfires, you know, the elements of nature, and then, you know, some kids didn't even know that they had it in them to, you know, be loving in the wilderness or the outdoors.
Right.
You want to say, they never, because they're all city folks,
yeah.
and they never used their chance. And so some of them never been camping. And so it was interesting.
Gosh, I can't imagine.
How to use the bathroom.
Was it male and female that joined? Or
was
it? Okay.
Yeah. And we, like I said, we always had a designated area. I go, girl or women to the left and men to the right, you know.
Man,
but, you know,
I would so be there. I grew up camping all the time, so I would so be there.
We'll be back after this quick break. Are you in the medical field looking for your next opportunity? Listeners, I'm proud to introduce you to Native American veteran-owned staffing company, Worldwide Medical Staffing. Owner and CEO Jackson Weaver is a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma and is a service-connected disabled veteran, where he and his team staff for commercial healthcare and government entities such as the Department of Defense, Department of Energy, and DHS, and specialize in staffing Indian Health and VA hospitals nationwide. Isn't it nice to know that our veterans are being cared for by staff who have been handpicked by a veteran who's been in the staffing business for 17 years? Healthcare job seekers, check out these open jobs on www.medical.com. If you're seeking temporary, long-term, or permanent placement of physicians, advanced practice, registered nurses, and more, check out www.medical.com. And Diako Ki to our medical professionals and to those who have served our country.
The 18th year, it was our last hunt, and it was a lot of fun. A lot of kids knew that. I told, you know, people that this is probably our last hunt because of political reasons, and so it was. We had probably almost 75 people go.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a lot of people. A lot of people, even professors and alumni, went with us, and of course, you know, the professors and alumni paid for their own ways, but. Like I said, we raise, you know, money from Walmart, State Farm, and some other places.
Wow. So you would get sponsors for these different students to go, or people to go.
Yeah.
And then what did you do with the
sponsors? We always had sponsors for our programs, because there was always something cool for the sponsors to get back. You know, we recognize them during events. You know, I have their vice presidents or presidents come, and sometimes we give them Pendletons or give them awards, or, you know, it was just fun, you know, give us something and we'll recognize you in front of 700 people or 800 people. And so, you know, it was a lot of fun.
And then what did you do with the meat from that hunt, those hunts?
Well, a couple of times we were very bold and aggressive, you know, and We actually processed the meat ourselves, and then the following year we're like, no, we're not doing this again. They go, let's just
that
make
is a big
hamburgers,
deal,
you know? Yeah,
right?
Because it's hard, you know, processing and
right.
A lot, yeah. I mean, you're trying to process two buffaloes, and you're talking about almost 2,500 pounds of ribs and legs and arms and
right.
Like the people from Oklahoma say, backstraps, you know.
Yeah. So true.
And our back straps are like, oh man, almost 5 feet long and probably the size of somebody's leg on a buffalo.
Right.
That's how big they are.
Oh
That's
my
how
gosh.
Big
oh my
the
God,
back
really?
straps are. Yeah.
Dang.
So yeah, it was like I said, it was a lot of fun. But like for crows, our delicacy is like the intestines, they make sausage out of that. And
Okay.
then like the different trite areas, you know, they boil that, and you know, where you make menudo, you know. Man, it's so traditional still having
Right.
internal organs. The crows love that, man. So you can smell it too, like, oh man, you know, some people don't like it, and like, but like a lot of the crows that eat that, you know, you can smell it from on a mile away, and like, oh, somebody's eating stomach, let's go look for some stomach, you know.
Just follow the smell.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you go, you don't even get invited to a feast, and you still go and eat some tripe, you know.
Right. Oh my gosh. So what kind of rifle does it take to kill a buffalo?
A high power rifle. You know, I use a 7mm Magnum. For me, but a lot of other people, probably use a very similar caliber. You know, because you know buffalo are hard to bring down. You know, they're really, really tough animals.
I bet.
And if you don't shoot them right, then and that's when, or if you don't have a gun that's powerful enough, you know, and you still, there's a little bit, you know, if you don't do it right, there's consequences too. So you just got to make sure you have the right tools to harvest the buffalo.
And are you trying to shoot them between the eyes or what part of the body?
Yeah, because you know both the male and female buffalo have horns, and so we try to place the bullet right behind the ear, behind the horn and behind the ear, because
okay,
that's where the neck vertebrae is connected.
Gotcha.
And so yeah, and that's without pain or anything like that. And like I said, I'm a big fan of buffalo meat, but when we hunt, you know, we don't want to kill the old guys, you know, because man, that's like trying to eat somebody's dry turkey for the first Thanksgiving dinner, you know. It's really tough and dry and stuff. So you want to kill one of like a 2 and 3 year old, which
gotcha.
Is the best meat possible. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, it's tougher and older meat when you get the older
guys.
Yeah,
there's a lot of meat in, but you don't want to kill those old ones, because it's so hard to try to maneuver them around while you're butchering them, and it's really
right.
tough. So the younger ones, man, you know, they their ribs on them, the back straps, the hindquarters are all delicious.
By the way, just so our listeners know, we have a great amount of respect for the buffalo. We're talking about how to kill them and eating them and all these things.
Yeah.
But really, you know, this is how our people survived for many, many centuries. And I've never met someone that hunts buffalo that doesn't use almost every single part of the buffalo, the horns, the intestines, all these different parts of the buffalo. And so please understand that we do have a great amount of respect for those beautiful creatures.
Yeah. And then like I said, it's also like our culture too. It's our, we're a buffalo tribe, and we're probably one of the first ones to have a buffalo herd that was given to the tribe. And they had their own pasture, which is the buffalo pasture. And at what point in the 70s, we probably had somewhere around 3,500 head of buffalo.
Wow.
Yeah. And so now everybody's that, we accidentally raised the bar to that high. And so now a lot of tribes, want to beat the crows, with the amount of buffaloes. And so,
That's the bar.
we didn't know. We didn't know we were in competition with everybody. So
You're like,
yeah, a
we're just
lot of
up here in
tribes have.
Montana doing our own thing.
Yeah. So a lot of tribes are now, reestablishing their buffalo herds, and
Oh
now it's
boy.
tribal owned. Yeah.
Oh, it's
Well,
on.
yeah.
The competition is on.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing with us about the buffalo and the hunts. Didn't you also at one point say that you would give some of the meat to some of the students as well?
Correct. Yeah. And then in 2008, I believe, 2007, the idea of having a pantry came about. And I was like, well, let's have a pantry. And a lot of the people on campus, some of the departments, they're all for it, but our administration told us we couldn't have a pantry. And because there wasn't enough money from the university and so on. So there's a
Oh,
lot of
okay.
excuses at the time.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, let me start the pantry. I just brought back almost 1,600 pounds of buffalo meat, and it's all hamburger.
Where are we going to put
And
this?
yeah, well, we put in our cultural center, and we have three freezers that we stockpile
Perfect.
our buffalo meat with. And so I was like, just tell somebody that, if you know somebody that needs hamburger for families or whatever, I go tell them that we have buffalo meat. And so a lot of students were going down into the food banks and getting non-perishable items, and then they would come and get buffalo meat. And so it was a consistent basis. And so for me, in order to ask for something, that thing that I'm going to ask for has to run out, because I'm that kind of person.
Right.
And it was right before the last week of the semester, which was probably, between Thanksgiving and the end of the semester, we ran out of buffalo meat, because that's how much students that were in need for food at the university. And then it was a big eye-opener, and I was a big advocate
I bet.
for a pantry. And then about, I think in 2015 or 16, that's when the university started establishing a pantry. I mean,
Aww.
it took that long for them to establish that, but by that time I was long gone, so I just heard
That's
it through
too
the
bad, but
news.
I'm glad it did happen. But I was one of those when I was in college. I went to college two different times. My first time I was there for 3 years and I had some of the same issues. I did not have food and I was paying my way through college and taking out loans and things like that. And you think about kids in that situation, it's really hard to study or concentrate when you're hungry. So, I love that y'all did that. And it's too bad the buffalo hunts don't go on anymore. I say bring them back. Hopefully somebody will bring them back. I'm just very, very inspired by the fact that you and the team came up with these ideas, and the success in the buffalo hunts was one of the reasons that you were presented the UNC Alumni Award. And yet there is another very interesting reason you were selected as well. So now tell us about the basketball team that you and others founded. So interesting.
Oh yeah, they're we one of the things in the Plains tribes, and maybe I mean, actually a lot of other tribes, we're fascinated with basketball. And so that when I was a director at UNC there, I was trying to find ways to connect with students, and one was getting to know them outside the classroom setting. So about 10 of us got together, and we we're looking for similarities and stuff. So we're like, well, let's play basketball. Let's all of us play basketball. So we made a team, and then some of the students, they're like, hey, no, intramurals is coming up. I'll pay for the registration, which was like $200. The graduate students were looking at Indian mascots. So we were halfway through the season. We're like, you know, let's support our fellow native students that are going to be doctors here pretty soon in education. So we came up with the basketball team Fighting Whites, and it was to protest a nearby school called Eden. Eden okay. Reds, and they have coolest worst native caricature ever, and so
the coolest worst one.
So yeah, it is just I meant non-coolest, sorry.
Oh, okay. It was the worst, but it was the coolest. Got it. Okay,
we're like, well, let's see what happens. So we came up with the Fighting Whites, and actually it was the students that came up with the Fighting Whites, and they came up with the white guy as the mascot, which is, you know, at first we laughed about it, and we're like, well, let's just play basketball and see what happens. And then a couple weeks later, we made national news, and somehow our message kind of got twisted up. You know, we were the Fighting Whites, and media put us as Fighting Whiteys. Had its own thing itself, and
oh boy.
So then we got so much media attention from ESPN to Rush Limbaugh. I don't know, you name it, man. We got lots of media attention, and people wanted to buy our shirts. And so, I mean, the business aspect of businesses, it's very rare that a native has its own business. So we didn't know too much about it. And so we were trying to figure out how to sell the t-shirts. And luckily we had the CU Law Center to help us out. First, we had to be a nonprofit. They established that in 2 weeks.
Okay.
For us to be a nonprofit. And then the company that we were working with at the time, which is Cafe Press, they wanted to sell our shirts, and they had everything. You know, they had real time transactions with credit cards, shipment, anything you can think of. They're like probably like Amazon, but a little bit better. So, I mean, they had everything ready to go, and all we had to do was sign the contract, and they were ready to sell our t-shirts. And then all of a sudden we get a call from Clipart. And Clipart said, you can't sell your t-shirts because you don't have a license with us. And we're not going to sell you a license because we don't sell them anymore. And Cafe Press was on the line with us, and their lawyer said, well, hold on, you know. He said, we bought a $5 license to sell your artwork. And Clipart said, yes, you did. It's right here. So we signed a contract and everything.
Thank you, Cafe Press.
Yeah, for $5, you know, a $5 barrier could have been
$5 barrier.
Yeah.
That's crazy to think about, especially when you think about how much y'all raised.
Yeah, exactly. And so the students signed a contract and everything, and we're a nonprofit within a matter of a couple of weeks, and the students started selling t-shirts. I believe our last game was somewhere around March, and the first check from Cafe Press showed up, and it was about $20,000 in t-shirt sales. But
were you shocked? What did you think?
I was so happy for the students, you know. I was like, man, you guys did good, you know. And they're like, and I mean, this is something nobody, no business school or anybody can teach. This is like,
Absolutely. And you even learned about the little hiccups along the way and the speed bumps, and learned how to partner with a good company like Cafe Press.
And there's no handbook to deal with media too. And that was such an interesting thing. But Cafe Press, what they did was for every t-shirt they would sell at $15, $1 would come back to the foundation or to the nonprofit.
Okay.
And that was the best we could do. So the students were like, well, you know, whatever we get. First check was $20,000, and then the second check was $75,000.
Oh my gosh.
And then the next check was $50,000.
Oh,
so that was a total of about $150,000 right there.
Did you have any idea it would get that big?
No, we did not. And so, I mean, if you look at $1, right, we got $150,000 for $1 for every shirt. I mean, can you imagine how many shirts they sold?
Right. And I don't even mean to turn this into a commercial about Cafe Press, because this is the first time I heard that part of the story. But I use Cafe Press as well. So I love Cafe Press because I don't have to worry about inventory, printing, mess ups in shipping. They take care of everything. You just put in there what you want. Yep. You give them your logo, and then they can make coffee mugs. They can make phone cases, shirts, sweatshirts, whatever. So, feel free to check out my Native Chalk Talk Cafe Press site, if you will. Again, sorry to turn this into a commercial, but I love that this story that you just told makes me love them even more. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and you know, and at the whole time, you know, Cafe Press also had a scheme, not a scheme, but they also had their business going in.
Sure.
And I believe they made, maybe that year, from what I read, they made somewhere between $9 to $10 million. And like I said, we're not taking all the credit, but I think because of the media attention that Cafe Press got,
it definitely
a lot
helped.
Of other people started started ordering different types of t-shirts from them as well.
That's great. Wow. Congratulations. It feels like everything you touch kind of just turns to gold. So keep on coming up with cool ideas.
Yeah, I wish. Yeah. So we had 150,000, and we're like, what should we do? I mean, we can't keep it for ourselves because nonprofits are not allowed to do that unless we're for profit. And so we're like, well, let's just make an endowment here at UNC. And as of this year, I believe it was the 22nd anniversary of the Native American Student Scholarships at UNC's anniversary. So I'm waiting on a report to tell us how much monies we've given and how many scholarships total we've given out since the establishment of the endowment.
That's fantastic.
And so we're very proud of that. And that, like I said, it kind of leaves our mark, our historical mark, that, you know, natives can succeed in higher ed and all over America. And I said, we're blessed to have a decent education on reservations, so more students can go into higher ed and become successful, but also hopefully they'll stick to their tribal stories and try to, you know, remember their tribal histories and their people.
Absolutely. Well, and one thing that's additionally cool out of this whole story is that you actually made an impact on other schools who would be using Native Americans as mascots, correct?
Yes. That, you know, that was a long time waiting, but it came 20 years after we did the Fighting Whites. Colorado passed legislation that bans all Native American mascots and Native American caricatures in public schools. And so unless some of the schools that were affiliated with different tribes, and then, but I think there was maybe two or three tribes that have affiliations before we started defining whites and stuff. So, you know, we're fine with that. But a lot of, I believe, somewhere around 30 to 35 schools got rid of their mascots
It's
from K through high
amazing.
school.
Look at the
Sorry,
difference y'all made.
30 to 35 school districts. Yeah. Like I said, was it the grains of justice takes a long time?
Absolutely.
Something
Yep.
like
You got
that,
to
I
plant
believe.
those seeds. In the write-up about the award that you won, it says, through the Fightin' Whites Foundation, your work contributed to the passage of Colorado Senate Bill 116 in 2021, which successfully banned the use of Indigenous mascots in schools. So, you know, congratulations to you. You should feel really good about that. I was curious, though, the school originally, when you came out with the Fightin' Whites logo and t-shirt and branding and all that, did they have a problem with it? Were they nervous about it?
They weren't particularly nervous until the news media came on campus.
And they're like, ah, we feel
I was
like this
sitting
is
in
a
my
Solomon
office.
Little Owl thing.
So my boss comes up to me, comes and visits me in my office, which is kind of rare at the time. And like I said, we have our freestanding cultural centers at UNC too. And a lot of, like I said, a lot of cultural centers across America are conglomerated or in the same building. And so ours
Right.
was a separate building and we had our own facility. And so, and that's like, I believe maybe at the time when I was working at UNC, there's maybe four or five Native American centers that were freestanding and we were one of them. And so,
Right.
but anyway, my boss comes and he says, you doing all right? And I was like, yeah, why? And I was working on a report and he was like, cause you know, you've been on the news lately. And I was like, no, really? I go, I haven't
Oh,
seen
no.
myself. And I was just teasing him, you know? And then after he leaves, I get another call from our media person. He said, you know, he's like, I'm finding ways to, get our message out to the media. That they're calling me night and day, and said I have about 500 messages from all kinds of news outlets wanting something, a response from UNC. And I'm gonna, he said, so I'm just gonna let you know that I'm gonna tell them that two wrongs don't make a right. And I was like, oh, all right, now I go,
there
that's
you go.
your prerogative, you know. And so, but
really,
they said, yeah, and you know, it didn't surprise me that he would say two wrongs don't make a right. That was kind of a cheesy way to get out. But it was interesting. Our board of trustee chairman at the time, his kids were going to school at Eden, and so it kind of tells you something that even though here's Native students that are giving their tuition monies to you, but we have a board member whose kids go to that school and they're also protecting that school as well. So it just kind of made sense where the priorities were at the time.
Comes full circle.
And
yeah.
then, like I said, I didn't see all this until I did a self-reflection. And like after that, I did learn a lot about university politics as well. And so, yeah, it was, you know, long story short, you know, we got it changed and we're like, let's move on to the next one.
And I mean, I know that you're not trying to be self-serving, but you won an award for what you've done. And, you know, for those, you know, things you had to fight against, the politics, the concerns with the media attention and all that, which actually brought money to the for students for scholarships.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, all those things were meant to happen. Sometimes you can't have something great happen without there being challenges and speed bumps along the way. So kudos to you. And I think it's a really good example for others who are out there trying to do good things.
Yes. My advice, my encouragement, and then don't stop. You know, it's a challenge, but once you think your fight has ended, then just walk away and it'll come to fruition, you know, down the road.
There you go. It's good advice. According to the Post-Secondary National Policy Institute, in 2020, 22% of the 18 to 24-year-old Native American population were enrolled in college, compared to 40% of the overall U.S. population. And since fall of 2010, Native American enrollment has declined from 196,000 to 123,000, a 37% decrease. And I hope Native American listeners who think there's no use for their attending college or adopting a trade will hear your story, Solomon, and know that you are needed out there. So please take a listen to Solomon's story and know that one person can do so much. Well, in fact, tell us about the dream you had along those lines.
Yeah, I my senior year, it was my last test on the last day of finals week, which is a Friday, and our test was from 1 to 4 p.m., and I got to class, and there was probably like 70 of us, and it was an economics class, and you looked at world economies, from closed economies to open economies, as well as the bank systems and how it works, you know, internationally and nationally. So I mean, it was a tough class, man, and so at 3:30, I was the only one that was in the class, and the professor was already grading papers, and she ended up grading them pretty fast. And he was like, you know, it's almost time to leave. And I was like, I'm almost done. And I wasn't. I was like, man, and then when there were seven questions and you had to answer five, and I just answered two.
Oh boy.
So anyway, I got it done. And she said, do you want me to grade it? I was like, oh, man. I was just writing stuff. And I was just so nervous. And I needed a B to graduate.
Right.
For some reason, I need a B. So so next thing you know, I gave her my paper. And she looks at it. And she's like, all right, Mr. Little. I was like, say, I'll see you at graduation. He said, you got an A in my class. Oh man, that was like the best thing possible, and I know I'm going to graduate. You know, so I walk outside, and the first thing I did was I yelled really loud. I go, "My problems are over!" Like that, really loud.
Right.
And it was a Friday afternoon. There was nobody in the parking lot, and I didn't have a ride to my house, which was on the other side of town. That was my first problem. So I was like, oh no. And then all of a sudden, here comes one of my friends driving down the road with his car. And I said, hey man, I need can you give me a ride back home? And he's like, all right. So he dropped me off at my apartment. And the next day, Saturday, was graduation. And so it was Friday. And I was like, man, I have a little bit of time to take a nap. And I go, my parents will be getting here at like 6 o'clock or something like that. And it was like 4:30. I go, I'm just going to take an hour nap. And when I was sleeping, I saw myself walking out of the building where I just got done taking my finals. And I saw myself coming out saying, my problems are over. And I don't know, it was kind of like in a spiritual sense. Right, you know, it's rare that I see myself in a dream, but in this one, I actually saw myself, and I was like, man, who's that good-looking crow? No, I'm just kidding. But I saw that in there.
Eight.
Anyway, so I saw myself coming out, and then all of a sudden, I heard this great big voice said, "Your problems are just now beginning," because he said, "I helped you graduate. And now it's your turn to help people help themselves and help people understand what they need to understand." And that was the big voice I heard. And then I woke up. And what was funny was when I woke up, I was crying because I was so moved by the dream. You know, and usually I don't cry in dreams and stuff. So I was like, man, that was a powerful dream. And so, yeah, so that's been kind of my path, is helping people and as much as possible, as much as I can. Yeah.
And I'm not saying the work you've done has been easy, but I do think it comes naturally to you to some degree, because you have a good soul and you have that calling and you want to help people and you're willing to do what it takes. Now, with that, I had promised that we would talk about Solomon's ancestral stories and about the Crow tribe. So stay tuned for part two, where I promise you'll get to hear some beautiful stories and you'll learn a lot too. Yakoki Solomon, for your time today. Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yakoki. Thank you, my friends.